they here gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. The end of the war and the 13th Amendment. In a war of attrition, the end finally came about reluctantly. Still focused on expelling and defeating the Confederacy, Lincoln was almost single-minded in his resolution. And yet, at the same time, his approach to dealing with newly captured Confederacy territory was both wise and compassionate. When asked by Union soldiers how they should treat the defeated soldiers, Lincoln is quoted as answering, "Let them up easy." This went hand in hand with his desire for true unification of the United States, and he understood that all the states would have to work together. At the same time, he sent commanders to these captured states to ensure that both moderate and radicals alike would not cause any more trouble. At last, the war had ended. In claiming this victory, Lincoln's greatest achievement was in introducing the banning of slavery into effective law for the entire United States. Although the first attempt to pass a law banning all slavery did not go through, the second time Congress finally agreed, and December 6, 1856, it was ratified and became the 13th Amendment to the American Constitution. Lincoln's assassination and his legacy. Perhaps the only thing more famous than what Lincoln was able to accomplish in his time as president is how he eventually died. While attending the theater on April 14, 1865, he was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth 5 days after the complete surrender of Robert E. Lee and his Confederate armies. Booth took the opportunity when the president was alone in his own booth and shot him point blank, killing him instantly. Later, Booth was tracked down and shot when he refused to surrender. Nevertheless, Lincoln's career and his pivotal role in helping to shape the economic, political, and social atmosphere of the United States lived on, and he became both an icon and a martyr to future abolitionists and human rights activists. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. I was sent for by Mrs. Lincoln immediately after the assassination. I arrived there in a very few moments, found that the president had been removed from the theater to the house of a gentleman living directly opposite the theater, had been carried into the back room of the residence, and was there placed upon a bed. I found a number of gentlemen, citizens, around him. I proceeded then to examine him and instantly found that the president had received a gunshot wound in the back part of the left side of his head, into which I carried immediately my finger. I at once informed those around that the case was a hopeless one, that the president would die, that there was no positive limit to the duration of his life, that his vital tenacity was very strong and he would resist as long as any man could, but that death certainly would soon close the scene. I remained with him doing whatever was in my power, assisted by my friends, to aid him, but of course nothing could be done. And he died the next morning at about 7:30. Excerpt from the testimony of Dr. Robert King Stone, President Lincoln's family physician. Fun fact. Although most history books do not mention them, there were Native Americans that fought on both sides of the Civil War. In fact, quite a number of them held high positions in the army. For instance, Stan Watty was a Cherokee Indian who was promoted to the rank of Brigadier General in the Confederate Army, and he was actually the last Confederate general to surrender. Another interesting fact is that one of the primary Cherokee leaders, a man named Solly, gained a reputation among the Americans and his own people for not only encouraging the Cherokee to side with other nations in their struggle, but also for being a prophet. During the Indian Removal Act, a number of soldiers came to the homesteads owned by his family, and several of them were attacked and killed. As a result, Solly was condemned for his part in the insurrection by other Cherokee bands and eventually hunted down and executed. Can you believe this actually happened? Which of these facts about Abraham Lincoln is not true? A. He developed a patent to aid steamboats run aground. B. He was a wrestler. C. He was a vegetarian. D. He hated the nickname Abe. Abraham Lincoln was known to love animals and even avoided hunting and fishing, but he was not a vegetarian. He actually was a wrestler, and he is the only president to own a patent. Researchers say that he did not care for the nickname Abe, and he preferred to be called by his last name. When Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, he had a leather wallet. What did they find in his wallet? A. A small photograph of his son. B. Confederate money. C. Speech notes. D. A penny. He actually had a Confederate $5 bill in his wallet when he died. More than likely, it was from a recent trip to Richmond or Petersburg in Virginia. Misconceptions. The South had little chance of surviving the war long term. There are some historians who argue that if the South had done X, then they could have won the war. The truth is, the South could not compete with the North's naval power, manufacturing, and firearms production. The North's population was more than double that of the South's. Not all slaves were freed with the Emancipation Proclamation. The proclamation declared free slaves from states and territories in rebellion against the United States. There were several areas of the Union that held slaves, such as Delaware and Kentucky, and slave-owning areas recently captured before the Emancipation Proclamation, such as Tennessee and New Orleans, which were excluded. The proclamation was not enforced in some areas until months later. It was not until the 13th Constitutional Amendment abolishing slavery was passed on December 6, 1865, that all slaves were officially freed. If the choice were yours, would you have demanded immediate emancipation of all slaves during the Civil War? In truth, the language of the proclamation was designed to aid slaves as much as possible without incurring the political ire of slave-owning Union states. The North, while generally anti-slavery, was still rife with political tension and feelings of inequality. The Emancipation Proclamation was a political tool that freed most, but not all, slaves in America. Reconstruction and the Gilded Age. North and South still divided. The Civil War was not kind to the Southern states. The infamous Sherman's March devastated a large swath of the South, and the emancipation of the slave population did not bode well for the economy of the regions, as they were heavily dependent on slave labor to produce such huge yields of cash crops. No longer having an indentured population of workers, many plantations fell into disuse and disrepair and were unable to keep their quotas. Many former slaves did not have a much better life once free, as they were released to live on small tracts of land owned by former slavers and required to pay a sort of tax on their crop yields to said owners. Rather than a brand new life of independence and freedom, these ex-slaves found themselves chained to a different sort of shackle, that of economic dependence on their old masters and inflexibility in terms of economic mobility. In other words, they were often drained of any excess cash and only made just enough money to get by, meaning they would never be able to advance in the world. Since it was not advantageous for a country to be left half in ruins, the effort to rebuild the South began as soon as the Civil War was over. The South pushed through many political reforms known as Black Codes, which required former slaves to sign yearly labor contracts or face arrest. In Mississippi, a contract had to be signed for the following year, and if the contracted left before the end of the year, earlier wages would be forfeited. In South Carolina, the only contracts open to former slaves were as farm labor or servant, unless they paid a tax of $10 to $100. Of course, this was the 1860s, and these were former slaves who had absolutely no assets to their names. Moreover, for employers, there were various versions of anti-enticement, which sought to punish those who offered higher wages for employees on contracts of others. The victorious North was furious over the laws that kept many African Americans oppressed and only nominally out of slavery. The anger led to radical Reconstruction, which saw Northern ideals forced on the South. From 1867, Congress took over Reconstruction from the executive branch and started to implement more free labor ideals. The more liberal policies led to a backlash in the South, one result being the formation of the infamous Ku Klux Klan. For whites, especially those that had had prominent holdings in slave labor, it was like their new government was suddenly disenfranchising them, A cruel twist of irony, considering this was the same thing they had been exercising on their slaves for the past century. As abolitionist sentiment began to overtake the United States, especially in the North, and this only helped widen the gap between whites and blacks in the South, often leading to violent confrontations and very strong racism. Jim Crow laws. Laws enforcing legal segregation began popping up in many southern states during the Reconstruction and into the 1960s. These laws were known as Jim Crow laws. Some states had these type of laws built into their state constitutions, such as Florida, and were targeted at public schools, public transportation, restaurants, and more. Due to Jim Crow laws, blacks and whites often could not use the same bathroom facilities and drinking fountains. Excerpt from Jim Crow laws in different states. Georgia. Amateur baseball. It shall be unlawful for any amateur white baseball team to play baseball on any vacant lot or baseball diamond within 2 blocks of a playground devoted to the Negro race, and it shall be unlawful for any amateur colored baseball team to play baseball in any vacant lot or baseball diamond within 2 blocks of any playground devoted to the white race. North Carolina. Libraries. The state librarian is directed to fit up and maintain a separate place for the use of the colored people who may come to the library for the purpose of reading books or periodicals. Oklahoma. Telephone booths. The Corporation Commission is hereby vested with power and authority to require telephone companies to maintain separate booths for white and colored patrons when there is a demand for such separate booths. That the Corporation Commission shall determine the necessity for said separate booths only upon complaint of the people in the town and vicinity to be served after due hearing as now provided by law and other complaints filed with the Corporation Commission. Wyoming. Intermarriage. All marriages of white persons with Negroes, mulattoes, Mongolians, or Malaya hereafter contracted in the state of Wyoming are and shall be illegal and void. Industrialization and new wage slaves. The United States was not to be left behind from its European brethren. The huge land area and resources offered by the country bode well for its industrial base. The large differential between wages in Europe and America enticed millions of Europeans to immigrate to the United States in the late 19th century. These immigrants filled the jobs the new American industrial engine offered. During this period of progress, huge advances in industrialization and mechanization were underway, especially in terms of agriculture. Unlike the crowded countries of Europe, North America and the United States offered an unprecedented opportunity for expansion, and spurred on by their relationship with the rest of the world, it really was a cash crop economy. It was also abundantly easy for any ordinary folk to try their hand at farming. And before long, the Midwest was a thriving agricultural center focused on any number of crops. It wouldn't be long before many farmers realized that it was more profitable to focus on a single crop, and this was evidence of a new type of specialization. With the advent of technological marvels that could help farms increase their efficiency, it was possible to produce a lot more surplus and help ease the lives of workers. Railroads allowed the cross-continental industry to arise, with the western lands producing minerals and other raw materials for the factories in the Old North. It is hard to overstate the effects that steam and coal power had on shaping the new frontiers. Those distant homesteads and towns, especially out toward the west, could now be accessed much more easily. In addition to help this, the government invested heavily in producing more and more railroads. This would often take the form of land grants that were given to companies. In exchange for a grant, the company could build through federal land and increase the overall wealth of the population. The South continued to suffer the after effects of the Civil War. While wages rose for immigrants filling jobs in factories, former slaves in the South were left disadvantaged. These millions of immigrants and many millions of Americans flooded into cities where the work was located. The notorious tenements of major cities arose, and the American industrial base started to overtake those in Europe. With the railroad and vast natural resources, America moved into heavy industry, and the steel production of America raced ahead to become more significant than the outputs of Britain, France, and Germany combined. The old colonial powers of Britain and France invested heavily in the railroads, which further expanded American industrial dominance. However, it was not just steel and coal that were moved on those trains. Crops and livestock from the central United States were ferried across vast distances to be processed in the newly built cities. Additionally, railways were also a great transportation hub for moving soldiers and militia, as well as building equipment to border towns. During the heyday of the railroad boom, it was also used in conjunction with the American Postal Service as a way to get mail across the country. As more money was needed to build and invest, finance became ever more important in the new American economy. The fledgling nation that had just a mere 100 years earlier been a small competitor to the great powers in Europe was now charging ahead to take center stage on numerous global affairs, both economic and technological. The new immigrants to the United States, as well as those already living there, pumped out a continuous, voluminous flow of inventions to shape the new era of modernization. The term Gilded Age comes from the notion that not all was well in the new era. Indeed, though prosperity skyrocketed, wealth inequality led to numerous conflicts. The labor movement fought for better working conditions and an end to abusive labor practices. The robber barons, businessmen who had amassed great wealth on the backs of workers, permeated the era. While they helped catapult America to the forefront of all things economic, the human cost was heavy. The name itself derives from the thief, a robber, and a type of nobility, a baron. A class that should not be present in a political system based on democracy. These men built huge empires and wealth for themselves while giving very little to their workers. Some, however, did become philanthropists who donated a significant portion back to the communities in the form of institutions that still stand today. The new industrial might of the United States served it well during the 20th century, during which it produced huge armaments and further built on the industry that helped the United States become a superpower. Women's suffrage. Although most people think of civil rights as being only an issue of race, discrimination on the basis of gender was also prevalent as well. As early as 1848, women were trying to achieve the right to vote. At the Seneca Falls Convention in New York, which was organized by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, women got together to see what they could do to get the same rights as males, particularly the ability to influence policy by way of voting. One interesting document that was produced as a result of this convention was the Declaration of Sentiments. The Declaration of Sentiments was very similar to that of the Declaration of Independence, except with woman added to a lot of the wording. Shortly after the end of the convention, many activists, including Susan B. Anthony, Stanton, and Mott, began to create an organization that would raise awareness of women's rights to vote. They also organized lobbies that would push for the government to give voting rights to women. When the Civil War came into full swing, the women's suffrage movement took a rest. After the war, it was time to get back to business. Stanton and Anthony founded the National Women's Suffrage Association, NWSA, in 1869. The purpose of the organization was to get a federal amendment passed that would allow women the right to vote. Later on during the same year, another major women's group called the American Women's Suffrage Organization, AWSA, formed under the leadership of Lucy Stone and Henry Blackwell. Unlike the NWSA, the members of the AWSA were big supporters of the 15th Amendment. They arranged their efforts around changing state constitutions rather than the United States Constitution. Although the two groups had slightly different ideals as to how they should go about getting the right to vote, they still had the same end goal. In 1886, the NWSA had gotten enough influence to get the idea of women's suffrage put before the House and the Senate. Unfortunately, it got shot down. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. Friends and fellow citizens, I stand before you tonight under indictment for the alleged crime of having voted at the last presidential election without having a lawful right to vote. It shall be my work this evening to prove to you that in thus voting, I not only committed no crime, but instead simply exercised my citizen's rights, guaranteed to me and all United States citizens by the National Constitution beyond the power of any state to deny. Preamble of the Federal Constitution says, We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It was we, the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor yet we, the male citizens, but we, the whole people, who formed the Union. And we formed it, not to give the blessings of liberty, but to secure them, not to the half of ourselves and the half of our posterity, but to the whole people, women as well as men. And it is a downright mockery to talk to women of their enjoyment of the blessings of liberty while they are denied the use of the only means of securing them provided by this democratic Republican government, the ballot. For any state to make sex a qualification that must ever result in the disenfranchisement of one entire half of the people is to pass a bill of attainder or an ex post facto law and is therefore a violation of the supreme law of the land. By it, the blessings of liberty are forever withheld from women and their female posterity. To them, this government is not a democracy. It is not a republic. It is an odious aristocracy, a hateful oligarchy of sex, the most hateful aristocracy ever established on the face of the globe. An oligarchy of wealth, where the rich govern the poor. An oligarchy of learning, where the educated govern the ignorant, or even an oligarchy of race, where the Saxons rule the African, might be endured, but this oligarchy of sex, which makes fathers, brothers, husbands, sons, the oligarchs over the mothers and sisters, the wives and the daughters of every household, which ordains all men sovereigns, all women subjects, carries dissension, discord, and rebellion into every home of the nation. Webster, Worcester, and Bouvier all defined a citizen to be a person of the United States entitled to vote and hold office. The only question left to be settled now is, are women persons? And I hardly believe any of our opponents will have the hardihood to say that we are not. Being persons, then, women are citizens, and no state has a right to make any law or to enforce any old law that shall abridge their privileges or immunities. Hence, every discrimination against women in the constitutions and laws of the several states is today null and void, precisely as is every one against Negroes. Susan B. Anthony, 1873. Determined to see changes, the NWSA and AWSA joined force in 1890 to become the National American Women's Suffrage Association. Now joined together, the NAWSA decided to gain voting rights on a state-by-state basis. At the turn of the 20th century, the mothers of the movement were getting too old to be in control, and so were succeeded by Carrie Chapman Catt. Other organizations like the Equality League of Self-Supporting Women were also making strides towards women's suffrage. They used parades, pickets, and marches to generate attention for their cause and to raise awareness about the issue. When Woodrow Wilson became president and was about to be inaugurated, a suffrage party in the nation's capital got out of hand and hundreds of women got hurt. Later that same year, 1913, a woman named Alice Paul founded the Congressional Union for Women's Suffrage, National Woman's Party. Paul had the organization do a number of demonstrations in front of the White House. Many members were arrested and even got put in jail as a result of these protests. By 1918, because of influence from Catt, Wilson changed his stance from opposing to favoring the women's suffrage movement. Because of their extensive involvement in aiding soldiers during World War I, he felt like women deserved the right to vote. Although the proposal lost in the Senate by a couple of votes, it did come back up the next year. It passed both through the House and the Senate, but took a while to be ratified by the states. While some states, like Illinois, Michigan, and Kansas, ratified the amendment fairly quickly, many of the southern states were completely against the amendment. Tennessee ended up being the deciding state, and with one vote, got the 19th Amendment added to the United States Constitution. Although the road was rocky, women had finally gotten the right to vote in the United States. Misconceptions. There were more African Americans in political office during the Reconstruction era than at any other time in American history. During a time of heightened political activism and coalition work between blacks and white Republicans, 16 blacks were elected to U.S. Congress. Over 600 were elected to state legislatures, and many more were elected to local offices. Hiram Revels was the first African American elected to the Senate. He ironically took the seat vacated by Jefferson Davis. Women had the right to vote before the 19th Amendment was passed. Women living west of the Rockies had the right to vote before 1914. The Wyoming Territory was the first to grant women the right to vote in 1869 and carried that with them into statehood in 1889. The Utah Territory and Washington Territory followed. History has its eyes on us today. America is still feeling the effects of the Civil War and Reconstruction today. Jim Crow laws arose as an answer to radical racial changes in the political and social spheres, creating a division between blacks and whites. Legal segregation of schools ended with the 1954 Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education and ended nationally in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act. Although legal segregation ended, de facto segregation, segregation in fact, without sanction of law, exists to some extent today.
Chapter 5. The Great War and the Great Depression. Immigration in the United States. Between 1870 and 1900, the United States saw a dramatic change in the makeup of its people. During that time period, an estimated 12 million people immigrated to the U.S. with hopes for new and better opportunities. Many were escaping famine, land shortages, war, crop failures, religious persecution, or rising taxes. They saw America as the land of opportunity. In the earlier part of the 1800s, many immigrants came from England, Ireland, and Germany. But by the end of the century, people were emigrating from places like China, Japan, Russia, and Italy. Immigrants entering on the West Coast were processed at Angel Island, and those on the East Coast were processed at the Castle Garden Depot in Manhattan, and later, Ellis Island. While many immigrants settled in cities along the coast, there were some inland states that tried to attract immigrants for farming opportunities. At the same time as America was receiving all of these immigrants, the factory system was seeing a huge uptick in technology and production, meaning that these factories need labor. Immigrants became a quick source of cheap and unskilled labor, and this dramatic shift in the workforce helped catapult American manufacturing to new heights and pushed America to become among the strongest world economies. This boom in industrialization is known as the Second Industrial Revolution, and it saw an increase in manufacturing ability. Steel manufacturing boomed due to a new process, and corporate giants gained ground, such as Andrew Carnegie and J.P. Morgan. During this time, America and the world saw advancements like no other. Edison created the first light bulb, while Nikola Tesla and George Westinghouse provided electricity for the World's Fair in 1893. There were major advancements in textiles, and the world fell in love with the bicycle and later Henry Ford's automobile. Ford was also responsible for popularizing the assembly line and bringing mass manufacturing, which is the foundation for modern manufacturing, to the forefront. Not all Americans were happy about this influx of foreigners and took measures to try and stop or slow down immigration to the United States. In 1882, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which prohibited Chinese laborers from entering the country, and an unsuccessful campaign in the 1850s attempted to stop Catholics from entering the country. Also notable was the Immigration Act of 1924, which put a strict limit on the number of immigrants allowed per year, 2% of the current population. This act was racially motivated and explicitly banned immigration of Arabs and Asians and placed some restrictions on women entering the country. This act came at a particularly tough time, as it limited the number of Jews who were trying to escape Nazi Germany in the 1920s and 30s. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. I was born Gudrun Hildreban and married Muller. Mr. Muller, who was from Denmark, immigrated here many years later, and we met in New York. However, When I started school in Chicago, where I grew up, needless to say, first of all, I couldn't speak a word of English, and I was the only child in the school that couldn't speak English. And it wasn't too happy the first couple of years, but my mama said, "Take heart, because someday you're going to be able to speak two languages, and all the ones that were teasing you will speak only one." And it was true. She was always right. So my teacher suggested, since none of the children could pronounce Gudrun, which is an old Germanic Scandinavian name, and a very beautiful name, I hear, she gave me a list of girls' names to choose from, so that all the kids could converse, know what to call me. So I picked a name starting with a G, as with my name, and it was Gertrude. I'm not very happy with it, but it has stuck with me all of these years. Gertrude Gudrun Hildebrand Muller, on changing her name at Ellis Island.
Constant wars and security. In 1898, the United States fought a war with Spain, who was completely unprepared for the conflict in its distant colonies. Cuba had wanted to split from Spain, and the United States declared its right to do so. Spain engaged in extreme measures to subdue Cuba. This was sensationalized in American newspapers, creating nationwide sympathy for the Cubans. In 1893, a revolt began in Cuba against Spain. The United States had a vested economic interest in Cuba, as it was the primary buyer and consumer of its major agricultural crop, sugar. The U.S. then sent the battleship USS Maine to Cuba to protect American citizens and property against anti-Spanish rioting in Havana and to pressure Spain into a diplomatic resolution. The USS Maine mysteriously sank, killing 250 sailors. President McKinley did not explicitly state that Spain had anything to do with Maine's demise, but requested military funds from Congress nonetheless. Conflicting reports state that the explosion could have come from the outside or internally, but historians are still not entirely sure what happened. The United States issued a series of resolutions that outlined Cuba's right to independence and that Spain should withdraw its troops from the colony. Shortly thereafter, the war erupted, and the United States quickly defeated Spain. Spain was ill-prepared for war and simply couldn't manage an army and a navy so far from their home base. The war was fought both in the Caribbean and the Pacific, as Spain had assets in the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico. With Spain's fleet demolished and feeling heavy losses, Spain demanded peace. The war officially ended with the 1898 Treaty of Paris. The treaty specified that the United States would gain all of Spain's non-African territories and Cuba would become a temporary protectorate of the U.S., meaning that the United States would hold a military presence in the area. Cuba formed its own government and officially declared its independence just 4 years later. Cuba gained independence from Spain and was left outside American territory. The United States was not only concerned with Cuba, though. Guam and Puerto Rico were lost to the United States, and they are still under some form of American control today. The much more populous Philippines were purchased by the United States for $20 million, and suddenly America had far-flung assets around the globe. The United States had become a global player, and less than 120 years after its own independence, the nation had risen to prominence to rival Europe. Its relative insulation from European wars and the vast expanse of resources and land afforded the United States, along with its freedom and wages that enticed large numbers of skilled labor, that gave it such a position. While the Monroe Doctrine in 1823 warned European powers to stay out of Western Hemisphere politics, the United States could now force Europe to stay out of such affairs. Furthermore, the United States could dictate terms across the globe. The Spanish-American War, though short, meant huge changes for America. Not only did U.S. territory expand into the Pacific, but also the war was seen as a unifying force that brought people together. Some saw it as a form of healing after the Civil War, as blacks and whites, northerners and southerners, fought together. Not long after the Spanish-American War, President McKinley was re-elected in 1900. Leading up to McKinley's first election, however, was the economic panic of 1893, a period of economic depression that caused serious drops in employment and caused many banks to collapse.
One victim of unemployment was Leon Czolgosz, who turned to anarchism. This ultimately led him to the belief that it was his duty to assassinate President McKinley, who he believed represented oppression. McKinley was shot twice in the abdomen in 1901 while in the Temple of Music at the Pan American Exposition's World Fair in Buffalo. His vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, who had risen to prominence with his famed Rough Riders in the Spanish-American War, took the mantle as the new president. McKinley was then the third president to be assassinated after Lincoln and President Garfield. Roosevelt's presidency was a mark of the Progressive Era, and one of his major achievements was establishing the National Park System with the intention of preserving the nation's natural resources and wilderness. He also wanted to display and show off America's newfound power in the world, so he orchestrated a naval world tour known as the Great White Fleet, where a battle fleet took a journey around the entire globe. Roosevelt was also instrumental in building the Panama Canal, and yet another effort to display America's world prominence, he helped mediate a treaty between the Russians and the Japanese, ending the Russo-Japanese War. This mediation effort earned Roosevelt a Nobel Peace Prize. World War I. The United States, surrounded by two vast oceans, kept itself mostly out of European politics. When World War I broke out between the various powers in Europe, the United States remained staunchly neutral. The American public had little interest in fighting a war that was not their own, and life in America was, in general, good. American troops were not meant to solve the centuries-old rivalries between European powers. At this time, the United States was still reeling from its own American Civil War, and there was little reason politically or economically to enter the theater of another conflict. Through the eyes of an eyewitness, all along our trench, rifles and machine guns spoke, our shrapnel was bursting over their heads. They went down in heaps, but new ones took the place of the fallen. Nothing could stop that mad rush. The Germans reached our barbed wire, which had previously been demolished by their shells. Then it was bomb against bomb and the devil for all. Suddenly, my head seemed to burst from a loud crack in my ear. Then my head began to swim, throat got dry, and heavy pressure on the lungs warned me that my helmet was leaking. Turning my gun over to number two, I changed helmets. The trench started to whine like a snake. The sandbags appeared to be floating in the air. The noise was horrible. I sank onto the first step. Needles seemed to be pricking my flesh, and then blackness. I was awakened by one of my mates removing my smoke helmet. How delicious that cool, fresh air felt in my lungs. A strong wind had arisen and dispersed the gas. They told me that I had been out for 3 hours. They thought I was dead. Arthur Emprey. However, as the war in Europe raged on, it became clear that there were a number of things at stake, and America became more and more politically interested. Under Kaiser Wilhelm, the German Empire itself recently formed wanted to build itself into a global power just as the United States and its neighbors had for a long time. This inevitably meant conflict between Germany and Britain and France. The United States wanted to stay neutral, but Britain was a close trading partner and Germany had blockaded the Isles in an attempt to defeat Britain. This was especially pertinent to the burgeoning industries of the United States, and in particular, agriculture. Many of the farmers and new agricultural steads of land and companies relied heavily on foreign export in order to remain prosperous. Germany had officially cut off this resource and, in order to enforce the blockade, started to attack any ship, neutral or hostile, on the high seas. The military power of Britain lay in its navy. Germany needed to defeat this. Unfortunately, this included passenger ships carrying Americans. Following two torpedo attacks against ships carrying American passengers, including the infamous and ill-fated Lusitania, public opinion in America turned against Germany, and there was a social and political movement that supported joining the other nations against Germany. Before this, there had been sharp division in terms of citizens' views, with many of them thinking it would be unwise to partake in a war so far overseas. In the previous war of 1812, America had seen firsthand how costly and expensive it was to wage a conflict that was not in close proximity to one's forces. However, following a resumption of German hostilities against non-combative ships, the United States eventually entered World War I on the side of the Allies. The irony, however, was that America at this time was not a particularly strong military presence. Aside from the casualties incurred by the American Civil War, the U.S. had also been threatening Mexico, but its army and navy were quite small in comparison to a superpower like Britain. Nonetheless, overcoming political barriers, Woodrow Wilson eventually managed to pass a National Declaration of War, which passed on April 6, 1917. What was interesting about their move, however, was that even though they fought with other allied nations, the U.S. remained staunchly independent in regards to its own diplomacy. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. The night before Wilson asked Congress for a declaration of war against Germany, he sent for me. I was late getting the message somehow and didn't reach the White House till 1 o'clock in the morning. The old man was waiting for me, sitting in his study with a typewriter on his table, where he used to type his own messages. I'd never seen him so worn down. He looked as if he hadn't slept, and he said he hadn't. He said he was probably going before Congress the next day to ask a declaration of war, and, well, he'd never been so uncertain about anything in his life as about that decision. For nights, he said, he'd been laying awake, going over the whole situation, over the provocation given by Germany, over the probable feeling in the United States, over the consequences to the settlement, and to the world at large if we entered the melee. He tapped some sheets before him and said that he had written a message and expected to go before Congress with it as it stood. He said he couldn't see any alternative, that he had tried every way he knew to avoid war. "I think I know what war means," he said. And he added that if there were any possibility of avoiding war, he wanted to try it. "What else can I do?" he asked. "Is there anything else I can do?" Frank Cobb, news reporter and confidant to Woodrow Wilson. Shortly after entering the war, President Wilson, along with a group of his most trusted advisors and British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, put together a list of explanations as to how they saw the outcome of the war. Wilson wanted the outcome of the war to be peaceful, and his plan for peace came to be known as the 14 Points. The primary purpose was to provide a public strategy for ending the war. Essentially, if he was going to endanger the lives of Americans in order to fight a war in Europe, he wanted everyone to understand why. The first 5 points of his speech were directed towards international affairs, and the last 8 dealt with things specific to the questions of how to divide the territory. The first point was about diplomacy. Instead of having secret dealings with different nations, everything would need to be out in the open. The second point was called the freedom of the seas. In other words, all international seas were to be free for navigation and trade, whether at peace or at war. The third point was the removal of economic barriers. In other words, there was to be free trading between any and all countries that accepted the peace that was to come. The next point involved the reduction of armaments. This point meant that all nations would have to reduce the total number of arms that they had on deck. Everyone's supply of weapons would dramatically decrease, the idea being that fewer weapons and smaller armies would mean less chance that a country would engage in war. The fifth point referred to the adjustment of colonial claims on different lands and regions. This point would be a bit tricky, but the basic idea was to make the claims over lands and regions a lot fairer. The next point specifically addressed both Russia and Germany. Since they were the primary forces behind Germany, Russia would be given the ability to make the decision as to what type of government it wanted to have. The point would drive Germany off of Russian soil and allow for Russia to fix the problems that had arisen as a result of being at war. The seventh point was about Belgium, the small country that endured a cruel beating at the hands of the Central Powers. The point called for Germany to completely vacate the region and allow Belgium to become its own independent country. The next few points were very much like the seventh point, with France gaining back territory lost, Italian borders becoming more clearly defined, Austria-Hungary, and Poland being allowed to become their own countries, and the Turkish people from the Ottoman Empire being given the ability to create their own country. The 14th and final point involved the formation of a League of Nations, which would serve as a diplomatic gathering of nation leaders with the intention of keeping all countries, regardless of their size, protected and free. By this time, the Allies were weary of having fought for so long, so the arrival of American troops was a godsend. They sometimes arrived in fleets of as many as 10,000 troops a day. Because World War I had been fought as a sort of attrition conflict through the use of trench warfare, many of the Allied troop movements had slowed or incurred such devastating losses that an end to hostilities was the primary goal for all parties involved. Coming to the war 3 years and millions of dead Europeans later, the United States, with its huge, untouched by war industrial base and population, burst onto the European scene and helped end the war within a little over a year. The final attack came in the Hundred Days Offensive, which marked the end of the German offensive until World War II, a decade and a half later. League of Nations and an era of prosperity. The introduction of mechanized warfare and the seemingly purposeless deaths of millions drove the desire to end the war. World War I was termed the Great War and the War to End All Wars because it was hoped that this display of brutal, efficient, mechanized death would stop the march of bloody conflict once and for all. One attempt to end the war between nations was to create a place for them to practice diplomacy before resorting to war. While the United States, for the most part, was uninjured in the war and wanted to implement a lasting and just peace, Britain and France wanted revenge for the deaths of millions of their citizens and the destruction of their lands by German ambition. The U.S. President, Woodrow Wilson, wanted the United States to lead the League of Nations, but, due to legal demands deemed unconstitutional by Congress, the League was created without the United States. As a result, Woodrow simply signed independent peace treaties with the other countries involved. The exclusion of the United States from the League was by no means a problem for the United States. During the 1920s, as Europe was still recovering from the war, American culture and economy flourished. The wealth of the United States doubled within a decade, and a great many Americans were granted access to consumer culture. The country's urban population was now more than half its total, and people across the entire continent were forming an American culture thanks to nationwide advertising and the communication links provided by new technology. Many were averse to the mass culture that was enveloping the nation, but the idea of consumerism had taken hold. There was conflict, one of the most famous being Prohibition. Responding to a wave of temperance movements, various states had already enacted their own forms of restriction on alcohol. A lot of the impetus came from a Protestant atmosphere that saw alcohol as being the root of evil and excess, and in the 1920s, a prohibition was signed into law, becoming the 18th Amendment to the American Constitution, banning and forbidding the manufacture, sale, or transportation of alcoholic liquids. Several states had strict laws regarding even possession of alcoholic substances. The ban led to a loss of tax revenue and various criminal activities as people were heartily attached to alcohol. At the same time, it seemed like a good idea to many. The previous 19th century domestic scene had been marked by alcoholism, family violence, and saloon-style corruption in politics. This created a divide in post-World War I America between the drys and the wets, or those who advocated prohibition, and those who did not. The main problem was that prohibition targeted the lower class much more than the middle class or wealthy members of society. A rich person could safely and easily keep or hide alcohol inside their house, but the penalties on possession for the poor was high and their access to it was diminished, creating public outrage. This led to the practice of bootlegging, which was the illegal creation, distribution, and selling of alcohol. Many people made their own alcohol, and a whole black market economy developed, even going so far as to smuggle alcohol across the Canadian border. In some more blue-collar neighborhoods, it also led to the creation of speakeasy establishments, often run by ex-bar owners who would simply sell their product secretly to those who wanted a drink. One of the most famous players in the whole Prohibition racket was the infamous Al Capone, who, along with a number of others, basically ran Chicago and was actively involved in the bootlegging industry.
Through the eyes of an eyewitness. In favor of Prohibition, January 22, 1931, to His Excellency Herbert Hoover, President of the United States, Washington, D.C.
Dear Mr. President, I am one of the hundreds of thousands of Texas citizens who voted for you for president in 1928 as against Al Smith, the idol of the liquor forces of America. Your election by an overwhelming majority gave me great joy, and I have not had any occasion to regret casting my vote first time for a Republican candidate for president. My joy at your courageous stand on the side of justice, honor, and purity to maintain national constitutional prohibition of the liquor traffic and to put forth every effort possible to eradicate the evils of this curse from our country even surpasses that of 1928 when you were elected president. I thank God that we have a man at the head of our nation who is not afraid to stand on the side of right, regardless of whatever the consequences may be. Very sincerely yours, J. M. Bledsoe.
Against Prohibition.
January 21st, 1931. Honorable Herbert Hoover, President, USA, White House, Washington, D.C.
Dear Mr. President, the report of the Wickersham Commission on Prohibition is a great disappointment to the substantial element in the Republican Party here. Of course, the dry element, which is constantly decreasing in numbers, is satisfied because no modification is proposed, although the more fanatical dries do not think the report is sufficiently radical. It is regrettable that more money will be expended in times like these to attempt the enforcement of our foolish prohibition laws when so much good could be accomplished with the money in other ways. It is equally sad to contemplate that the rule of bootleggers and the crime wave will continue, and no doubt increase in spite of anything done in the way of more strict prohibition enforcement. But worse than all of these things is the conviction of a majority of our people that no prosperity is possible in this country until we modify the present prohibition laws. In this view, I am certain the people are correct in that no prosperity is possible under present conditions. There is no reason why we should not be as prosperous as the Republic of France if we had as sane laws and practices affecting the liquor question as France. Advocating the maintenance of prohibition without some sensible modification, the Republican Party is doomed to defeat in the next presidential election, regardless of who may be its candidate. For conditions will become so deplorable before 1932 that 75% of the people will demand a change. Tempt and more strict enforcement will only further enrage all except the ultra-dry fanatics. As an ardent Republican, I trust something can be done to change the present liquor laws and bring back confidence and prosperity. With sincere feelings of the highest personal esteem, I am, yours very truly, F. C. Finkel.
Eventually, even the main proponents of prohibition realized it wasn't working. First of all, it was causing a lot of strife between classes. Secondly, there was really very little way to efficiently police the ban on alcohol. And lastly, and most importantly, alcohol was a very reliable cash crop. Before Prohibition's inception, almost 14% of the GDP had been earned from the production and selling of alcohol. As a result, Prohibition was eventually repealed, turning over the 18th Amendment and bringing in the new 21st Amendment. The Roaring Twenties. The 1920s was a period of great economic and social change. While the 20s conjured the image of a flapper girl for many people, the fact is the 20s saw major advancements in consumerism and a great deal of change in popular culture. For the first time in American history, more people were living in cities than in the country, and the 20s saw the nation's total wealth nearly double. The nation started to become united under the same products, and national advertising and chain stores became the new norm. One of the biggest hallmarks of the 1920s was the boom in popular culture. Movie theaters were a major form of entertainment, and the 20s brought forth jazz to mainstream culture. This period of time is also known for the Harlem Renaissance, a period of great advancements in art, music, and literature for blacks. Harlem, a neighborhood in northern Manhattan, was the hotspot of activity. Many blacks had moved to the area as part of the Great Migration, wherein blacks were moving from the South into black neighborhoods in the Midwest and Northeast. The black middle class was growing, and Harlem attracted artists, musicians, poets, and scholars such as Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, and Claude McKay.
Women also became more equal members of society. In 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution passed, granting women the right to vote. Women were working in factories and even starting to hold white-collar jobs, such as secretarial work. Women were more independent than they had ever been before, and advancements in birth control allowed women to have fewer children, while modern conveniences, such as vacuum cleaners, eased some of the burdens of housework. The Great Depression. The United States of America is now one of the strongest economies in the world, but that wasn't always the case. There was a time when the economy of the U.S. took such a hit that suicide statistics rose to an unprecedented number. That time was known as the Great Depression, the darkest 10 years in the U.S. economy.
How it started. Even though the Great Depression happened decades ago, economists are still debating its actual causes. The most common belief is that it all started right after the 1929 crash of the stock market, ominously remembered as Black Tuesday during the Roaring Twenties. Right after World War I, rural Americans started moving into the cities because of the sudden boom in the industrial sector. While the cities did become more prosperous, this also led to overproduction on the agricultural side. It was a time of excess back then. The people thought that the stock market would only continue to rise, despite much speculation to the contrary by financial experts. Other theorists point out that the cause was low income and employment coupled with a banking crisis in which nearly a third of banks effectively disappeared. The problem was, in such a volatile economy, if one bank happened to go broke, it created a chain reaction, sort of like dominoes running into one another. Once this process picked up momentum, it would become impossible to stop, which is exactly what happened. Some economists, including Milton Friedman, suggested that the Federal Reserve was to blame for not bailing out banks by lending them money in order to stay afloat. One of the primary reasons that the Federal Reserve couldn't do this, however, was that in printing new money, they would be violating the gold standard, which said they needed to have a certain amount of backing, almost 40%, on notes that they produced and sent out. Then things started to go south. The steel manufacturers' production slowed down. The construction sector was sluggish. The automobile industry wasn't selling as many units as they used to, and the people were racking up huge debt. Despite all of these bad omens, companies continued to sell their stocks, and the people continued buying them in the hopes of striking it rich. On September 20th, 1929, the London Stock Exchange crashed following the arrest and conviction of top British